Click on that, got it. Hang on. Oh, yeah. Which is an interesting one and has a degree of, obviously it has relevance to your work, but in a particular way. So what you've got in your notes that have been sent to you is a framework. So that you can, if you know a basic framework, you can make your own, what you ever want to make of it, depending on what you're doing. So it is a framework of definitions and applications. But actually, if we think about the psychoses, it's you're not going to be treating someone with active psychosis on the whole, because the working definition of psychosis and a psychotic state is severe mental ill health producing disordered behavior and thought processes, which cannot be explained in terms of extreme eccentricity of normal behavior. Contact with reality is impaired or lost. So someone in that state is not going to be coming forward for autogenic training. However, you may have someone who has had psychotic episode and is under treatment. And I happen to have had one or two people who perhaps, because do not treat people with psychosis, you wouldn't have, but someone who is maintained and that who is keen to do it, with them, with thought and a sort of explanation. One person who came to the hospital was a woman who'd been severely ill, and she's one of the best students I ever had. And but because having a mental illness isn't just one thing, like it's depression or anxiety or psychosis or bipolar or schizophrenia, any of that. Each of those diagnoses or each of those labels is a composite of things that can happen. If you are depressed, then you're probably anxious. You probably can't sleep. So everyone is not just a fixed thing like I've got appendicitis, da-di-da-di-da, or I've got high blood pressure. It is a composite of mental functioning, which may or may not be accessible or maybe not desirable to have in AT. But it's good to have a working knowledge of the basic framework of mental illness. So what I'm going to do with this, I think it is it an hour, Jane. Am I on for an hour?
It's 45 minutes officially,
Okay.
but if you can't, then
Well, I'll see how I go because I've got quite a lot I want to say. So what I thought I'd do with this presentation is just go through a few of the structure of psychosis and that. And as you're listening, you can be thinking about people that you know, situations you've had, and so on. And also because and then we're going to go on to psychotropic drugs. Because the development of psychotropic drugs are drugs which have an effect on mental functioning. So because they have really mostly been developed in the last half of the previous century, their development has been very much part of my practice. So I thought it would add a little bit of spice to the thing for me to tell you about my personal experience of these drugs being introduced as I was working in general practice, which is quite interesting. So really, we're going back to 1950s and when I became a medical student and sort of started, and that's quite a long time ago, sort of three quarter of a century of development of psychotropic drugs, which is quite a lot. To ask you, I mean, all of us, Donna, Jane, Tricia, Bev, have you particular experiences of mental illness or psychosis in your near people or relatives, or people you come across, anybody got any experience and views about a psychotic episode? Yes, Jane.
Well, it's so long ago, and I was quite distant from it that I don't know that I've got very much detail to say. But my cousin was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia
Yeah.
in her teens, and I wasn't living alongside it, but I know that it was a very difficult time, and well, she ended up sadly dying when she was only 19, and that was just out of a muddle at the hospital, but she fell out of a window. So
Well,
that
she wasn't looked after properly. Presumably she fell out of a window.
well, actually, it, you know how windows only open so high?
Yeah.
Now, that was the
That
reason
was the
that
reason,
that's when it came in, because the windows were perfectly ordinary, and she was in hospital. And she ran up the stairs and opened the window, and I don't think she knew what she was doing, and
Well,
she fell out.
that is a tragic account of someone who is severely psychotic.
Absolutely, yes.
And not only that, but the effect and the history it has in the family. I mean, she was a cousin of yours, but the effect on the family must have been profound. And it is so,
Devastating.
mental illness within the family has repercussions throughout. And it's actually the family, as well as the treatment, sort of dealing with a person which is so complex with psychosis. I mean, I have a daughter-in-law who has bipolar, and she has very severe has had very severe episodes of mania, and it has affected, I mean, the generations, parents, grandparents, children, but in terms of modern medication is completely reversed, as reversed as well as it could be, by one of the newer antipsychotics, which I'll talk about later on. So, severe mental illness, psychosis, are a very significant and very difficult to treat condition. As you say, contact with reality is lost, and there are also sort of various features of the psychosis. You have the manic depression, or usually we don't call it manic depression now, bipolar affective disorder, where you have alternating attacks of depression or mania. Mostly, I think that the problem lies with the attack of the overactive, the manic phase, rather than the depressive phase. Because the depressive, the clinical features of the manic phase, and remember, this is somebody who is, who's just been jogging along, and suddenly begins to have these sort of features which might come on insidiously, and thought to be, oh, they're a bit odd, they're a bit this, they're a bit that, they're a bit the other. But the features are irritability, overactivity, distractibility, inappropriate behavior, reduced sleep, increased appetite, increased libido, flight of ideas, expansive ideas, grandiose delusions, hallucinations, and impaired insight. Now, if you put together impaired insight, that's the sort of start. This person has no insight. So they, you could say in inverted commas, they're not responsible for their behavior. And if you actually use the ones in manic phase, which is grandiose delusions, flight of ideas, expansive ideas, which one of us wouldn't want to feel quite like that? I mean, it's the opposite to depression. And so the person who is in a state of hyperactivity, hyperarousal, hypergrandiosity, or they don't actually want to be treated. They've got no insight and no insight in their behavior. Therefore, they don't know that they're being this, but they actually very resistant to having treatment, because if they have the depressive episodes, they're jolly pleased. Pleased. That feels good. Feels good. When did you last feel grandiose? When did we last feel grandiose? And so on. So it's a difficult one to treat with the person's acceptability and the person's cooperation, which so when we've got the depressive phase, we've got the slowing down, the retardation, the loss of concentration and interest, loss of peak experience with shame and guilt for manic behavior. Well, we can all, again, you can see with those features, we all feel like that now and then, slowing down a bit, loss of concentration, loss of peak experience, sort of borderline depression. But this is when it becomes a permanent feature and you're stuck in that. It's like the weather that's absolutely stuck in that sort of thing. And of course, that's a bit that is perhaps more easy to treat. So now that's the two phases. And we can look at the functional psychoses, which the one that we're probably most familiar with, which is labeled schizophrenia. And I think it's such a common word. It's a word that's in common parlance, isn't it? Someone's schizophrenic, and not as someone colloquially thinks, oh, that's someone with a split mind, that sort of thing. But it continues to be something that has actually no known cause. And it's I mean, there are certain things that it could be. So we've got several forms. We've got simple is schizophrenia is said to be odd, eccentric behavior and ideas. Well, we can all be a bit like that, can't we? It's a question to what degree. So again, these features of someone's behavior are always part of something that's normal behavior, but is inappropriate, not manifested. Do you see what I mean? So it's very difficult to actually say, you have got that, because everything merges into everything else. So another type of a definition of the schizophrenic condition is hebephrenic, thinking may be bizarre and regressive. Catatonic, I think, is quite, I don't think that's the most common, where you withdraw. Catatonia is where you withdraw into physical and mental stupor. I have witnessed that when I was working at a mental hospital. And it's tragic and awful to see someone fixed, not by drugs or anything, just by their mental functioning. And I think perhaps we're more familiar with the paranoid, where they have de delusions of persecution and personality. So the symptoms are thoughts, emotions or actions are experienced as under alien control. Now, as I'm saying those words, it's so glib to say that, but imagine that your mind is now not yours. It feels as if it's been taken over. So this is for the person who has this is scary stuff, isn't it? Isn't it? Passivity is a sort of just accepting and just allowing things that are happening. And I think we're also very familiar with hallucinations, which are sensory perceptions. Now, as you remember, we have five senses. We have both speech, we have touch, we have taste, we have smell, and we have sight. So you can have a hallucination, which is a false sense, a false perception, which are not due to a stimulus. So you could see things, you could hear things, you could smell things. This is part of your sensory cortex, which is actually not functioning, malfunctioning. And again, frightening. And then delusions are again the ones that we're very familiar with, which are disorder of perception, which is disordered belief. So the ones that we're probably familiar with is the person who actually says that they're hearing voices, and these voices are telling them, saying them horrible things and criticizing everything they do, or even telling them to do something. And there we're getting into really forensic psychotic condition. We've heard about these. So you're not going to have people coming in that state for autogenic training, but it's there. It's part of humanity. There's a very good book called Human Traces by Sebastian Foulkes, which is very much about that. Well worth reading. Gives some very interesting different accounts of the history, the fact that this is part of our delusions and hallucinations are probably part of our natural development of our brains over time and will continue to be. So in that you're not, I mean, have any of you come across, oh, Sebastian, yes.
Yeah, many times. Yeah, when I was a student, I mean, where I work in the past. But I remember a very funny case. There was a lady on the street, and all of a sudden she starting shouting, "Get out of my body! I had enough of you." So she was having some sort of internal, experiences, like she thought she's possessed or something, I find it very weird. So she was shouting in public, "Get out of my body!" I think she might have schizophrenia, I believe.
What was the place that you were?
No, it
What?
happened on a street. No, it was a random person. She had a very weird behavior, and all of a sudden
Well,
she
how did you come across her?
no, I mean, I just walking on the street, and she
Oh, I
was next
see.
to me on
This
a
is some
street happened. Yeah, and all of a sudden she was shouting round. I mean, it wasn't directed to someone else. She was saying loud, "Get out of my body! I had enough of you," and I assume it was like an hallucination, something internal, I believe.
What was your response to when this happened on the street?
I mean, I think by that time I was a teenager. I was a bit
Yeah.
scared. I didn't know what to do.
But what did you feel? Do you remember? What did you think?
I was scared.
You're scared.
Yes.
There we are. I was scared. And I think that's an important thing because it is scary. And the
I mean, I think
public.
it was the first time when I came across. Yes, yes,
Yes,
yes, yes,
well,
yes,
for
yes, yes.
anybody, it is scary. It is scary. And that becomes the difficulty of treating people who are psychotic, who have severe, enduring mental illness. And I can actually begin to tell you how I became involved in that. But first of all, I want to move on to the concept of psychotropic drugs, because that's this is something you will come across because you have people who you teach you on psychotropic drugs. So the definition of a psychotropic drug is one which acts on the brain. Okay. They're substances which have some specific psychoactive on the brain. They affect mood, change behavior, shift perception and alter the state of mind. The prescriber, the person prescribing them, carries a considerable responsibility for the prescribing of them carries a considerable responsibility for the prescriber, the patient, and society. And I think that's very, very important to take that on board because the psychotropic drugs differ from the use of drugs in a physical illness in three important ways. Psychotropic drugs suppress psychological symptoms and morbid behavior, which has no known physical pathology. Exactly how they do this is unknown. Thus, the justification for their use is based entirely on clinical experience. In other words, empirical use of drugs that have been put on the market have been found to have this and found to have that effect. So that's a very important consideration. You're not treating an infection with antibiotics. You're not treating a pain with it. You're treating a disorder of thought and behavior and mood with a psychoactive drug. The mental illness interferes with insight and often the individual's understanding or acceptance that they're ill. So this isn't like someone going to the doctor and saying, I've got a chest infection, here's some antibiotics, jolly good. This is someone who A, doesn't know they're ill, and secondly, refuses to be treated. So this is really has a quality to it. And that's why in terms of our work, autogenic training, you're unlikely to get someone who is at that point in their lives because they will not be seeking this sort of help. However, if they have been treated and they're stable and they want to particularly deal with an aspect of their illness that they're left with, although they're functioning well, and that reminds me of this patient that I had at the hospital who came, she'd been ill, she'd been treated, she was an academic, she was now working, she had a family, but she had a history of very, very, very severe breakdown. However, I think it was that she had a degree of anxiety there. She had researched autogenic training herself, so what she wanted to deal with was what she was left with, which possibly, and I may be making this up, possibly was the concern or stroke anxiety or stroke fear that she would have a breakdown again. But she was absolutely in touch, and I taught her individually at the hospital, and she was brilliant. So that's that. You know, there are still, if you're have a illness like this, it doesn't just manifest itself as one thing. You could not be sleeping. You can be this, you can be that, you can be depressed, you can be anxious, you can be fearful, you know, all sorts of things. So it is a whole conglomerations of all the feelings and the emotions that we can have. So mental illness interferes with the insight and often the individual's understanding or acceptance that they're ill. They may be resistant to accepting treatment. That certainly comes about. I have had a time in general practice when I've been called to someone who is, you know, is dangerous and psychotic, and had to deal with that. Which reminds me, if you'll forgive me, with some anecdotes because they're really quite important. When I was first doing a general practice locum, which is way back when I'd only just got registered, I did a locum general practice in my hometown of Barrow-in-Furness, and the doctor whose locum I was doing was a single-handed practitioner. He hadn't had a holiday for 11 years. He said, "Oh, I'm come and do a locum for me." So I said, "Oh, yes." So I turned up with my bag and went on. And his practice was amazing. He didn't take any notes. He just gave everybody vitamin B injections and they loved it. So that was a long time ago. But I had one afternoon when I was called out to an emergency. And this emergency was somewhere in the town, and it's mum's gone mad again. And she's threatening us with a knife or something like that. So in that, you know, ignorance is bliss, I get my little bag and off I go down there. And there's all the family are there. And there's a very large woman sitting there looking very, very unwell with a knife. I'm thinking to myself, perhaps here, discretion is the better part of valor. So, as I remember it, I did have medication in my bag. There were back streets there. I said, "Come and meet me round the back." So we went there, and I gave her son, I think, two Largactyl tablets, and I said, "Put these in her tea." And I scarped, and then I got the mental health people in. But it was this sort of thing. You had to know. But there was another one similarly when I was called to, and I did actually have an injection of Largactyl, which I had to give. And this is not, it's not easy medication. It really isn't, treating someone against their will. So, difficult stuff, really difficult stuff. And the third reason why you have to be careful about that, disturbances in behavior is found in mental health have repercussions on family and friends, and therefore treatment of individuals may harm or help those around them. I think this is very salutary words. You won't be doing that, but it is done. It is done. And I know my daughter-in-law, the grief and the confusion and the tragedy that's occurred when she has been ill, really, really, really ill. And now she's well. She's on one of the newer antipsychotics, and she's well. So anyway, there we are. Psychosis has, in the extreme, has all these bizarre features of behavior, out of touch with reality, difficult to treat, danger to themselves, danger to other people. I mean, we know about that from the news that we have when someone has been murdered and so on. And then there's incarceration, there's the Mental Health Act, there's being detained under the Mental Health Act. And that, of course, still goes on, and it's a very important safety place. But that whatever the mental aberration, whatever's going on in that person's mind, it's a mixture. It isn't just one thing. It's a mixture, and everybody will have a particular feature. Some will be fearful. Some will be violent. Some, do you see what I mean? It's all the features of depression, anxiety, grief. Put all those together in a big, and you can do, and anyone will have a particular propensity for one or the other. And that's why treatment with psychotropic medication has to be very skillful. And I think we also know now that the use of certain drugs causes a lot of problems. So I think really what I want to do now is to, first of all, ask if anybody wants to say anything while we've got to this point before I get on to the drugs. Bev.
Yes, I'm reading in your notes that it's not exactly certain how they work.
Yep.
I was just curious, like, if you could summarize, how did they find these drugs?
Oh, well, that's very interesting, Bev, because that brings me up to one of my anecdotes about the development of psychotropic drugs in the last 70 years, which has been my time of being in on the front line, as it were. When I was this is a little background to your question. Actually, before I say that, you could say that the development of Largactyl was serendipitous. Now, I'll get to that in a minute. In 1960, I was a medical student, and I got a holiday employment as a nursing assistant at one of the old psychiatric long-stay hospitals. They've closed now, and all of these psychiatric hospitals that were really a whole universe where people were incarcerated all their lives. I think every area had one. This was in Prestwich in Manchester. And these are the asylums that were built in the 18th century. And people were incarcerated by their family, by this, by that, or by the other. And some people went in at a very early age and lived there till they died, and so on. So when I went to this hospital, it was before the 1973, 74 Act, where they closed them down and put mental health treatment in the community. And my former husband was part of the Butler report that gave a report on the shutting down of these mental institutions. Anyway, prior to that, I was working in one at Prestwick, Manchester, and I was on the what they call the admissions ward. The admissions ward was in about oh, I don't know, 50 people in a great big long ward with dozens of beds of old people who had varying degrees of physical problems like acromegaly, cretinism, a thyroid problem, and they'd been incarcerated because they'd had a mental aberration of their condition, the hypothyroid and so on. And in those days, so they'd been there all their life. And so I went there and I was pretty shocked. I think it was the most difficult job I ever did. Pretty shocked to see what happened. And that brings me to the development of psychotropic drugs, because at that point, this is 1960. To my knowledge, only one antipsychotic had been discovered. So I was there working as a nursing assistant, and the matron, who was a woman in a green serge tunic like Patty Jakes, a real matron, wanted to talk to me, and she said, "And you have wanted to say that you, I've been obviously observing how the patients were treated, which was pretty odd." She said, "I want you to know that until we had Largactyl, which was about 10 years before, 8 years before, it was impossible to treat to hope you except by active physical force." And Largactyl had made it possible to treat people as human beings, because in many ways they hadn't been. It was a very salutary experience. And that, to answer your question, Bev, Largactyl was discovered because it's a relative of the antihistamines, phenothiazine, and it was discovered while research work was going on to the work of to antihistamines, and they discovered Largactyl had this effect. And I don't know how, but this is the story. It had an effect on the mania. Oh, excuse me. On these symptoms and manifestation of psychosis. You won't believe this, but Largactyl has quite a, it's an antiemetic. It stops you feeling sick. As a relative of the phenothiazines, it has an antihistamine action. And this was being discovered. So someone came up with the idea of calling it Largactyl, which means large action. Imagine that. Anyway, at this hospital, they had for nighttime sedation, people got an injection of formaldehyde, which was the most, do you remember this, Jane?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely disgusting stuff.
Yes.
So that's how things were. There was very little else. So that's the first of my stories. So I now want to move on to discussing the psychotropic drugs, which I've given you the definition, and the different groups are anxiolytics, hypnotics, antipsychotics, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, anticonvulsants, and anti-Parkinsonian drugs. Now, all of this you have access at your fingertips through Google and through just looking. You can look up absolutely anything. But it's nice to have an overview of where they come, because they cross over. It isn't that there is one anxiolytic, there is one hypnotic. They all cross over because you're dealing with somebody's mind, and your mind is not like my mind, and my mind is not like your mind. Do you see what I mean? So we have a different response to these, which is why the prescribing of them is not blanket. It's actually looking at the features of that person. If you're depressed, you might be massively anxious, and it's the anxiety that's making you depressed. If you're anxious, you might be depressed because it's a bit miserable going around being anxious and fearful all the time. So all of this is crossing over. And these sort of features you will come across. You will come across. And you will come across people who are on one of these groups of drugs. So I wanted to just carry on about. I've got something here about neurotransmitters. That's really quite interesting because that's a more recent understanding of the functioning of the brain. And if you look at that, I don't want to spend too much time on that because you can, it's there for you to look at. And these neurotransmitters are substances that are being produced in our brain, and they're all interacting. So if you actually have a look down what they do, it's pretty complex up there. Anything interrupting that is could be positive or could be negative. So psychotropic drugs I've put here act on neurotransmitters in two ways. They can be agonists. They increase the action of a neurotransmitter by activating the receptors on the wall, or an antagonist attached to the receptor of the cell wall blocks its action, therefore preventing the neurotransmitter from acting. So you're prescribing prescribing one of those, and it could do either. Jane.
No, I'm fine.
Oh, okay. So my first sort of personal experience was at the hospital, Prestwich. I think it was just called Prestwich. Gosh, had it got another name? What might I don't know. Prestwich something was about Lagactyl and the beginning of the antipsychotics. Up until that time, we had only barbiturates and pyraldehyde. So Lagactyl was the antipsychotics, as well as being antipsychotic, they're also hypnotic and sedative. We've got Lagactyl produced in 1952, the first of the group of drugs that has been phenothiazines, discovered by French scientists working on the actions of antihistamines. So you can see how actually hit and miss this was. They weren't looking for it. I mean, it really is. And you have to bear that in mind when you're treating someone. It might completely, you know, deliver somebody, and it might not. But they have hypnotic and sedative actions. Haloperidol was the next antipsychotic, chemically related to pethidine and distinct from the phenothiazines, but similar. And I remember, I'm now in general practice, and the people had came and had haloperidol injections, and that was always not a happy thing to do, to have people coming for this these injections of antipsychotics, because they weren't nice. I mean, they weren't that they made people feel better. They just stopped them being so ill, sort of. So the site of action of these drugs was not fully understood until 1963, when their antagonistic effect on dopamine was discovered. thus explaining the Parkinsonian side effects. Now, the Parkinsonian story is an interesting one. Do you know that? The one about, have you all read or seen the film Awakenings? Oh, you must know the history. Jane, do you know the history of Awakenings?
No, because
No.
I never saw the film, so
No, well, what happened was that after the First World War, we had the flu epidemic. Yes, flu epidemic. And the flu epidemic produced this thing they call the sleeping sickness, where people literally went to sleep. And so they were incarcerated into mental hospitals. And then there was, by chance, the discovery of L-DOPA, which is a drug that acts on the dopamine transmitter. And these people began to wake up. And I can't remember what year that was. It was probably 50s. And again, you know, we've got long COVID, which is very similar, not quite the same, but very similar, where part of the functioning of the body just stops, as it did with the aftermath of influenza. So things happen, things happen. So there were some side effects from the antipsychotics. And you have, you see, like every drug, wonder drug. I mean, I've been on the receiving end of this, and I'll tell you about some wonder drug, wonder drug, wonder drug. Oh, it's wonderful. We've got that. And then you use it, and then suddenly it's overused. It's overused. It's not, it's abused. It's not used, it's abused. And when you have abuse, then you get problems. And then, oh my goodness me, this da-di-da-di-da. So it's not use, it's abuse. I mean, I've gone through several things where things have been coming in that's absolutely, it's the miracle drug, it's this, that, and the other. It has a place, it is effective, but it's, if it's abused, we get problems, and then we get this, that, and the other. So what we have is, right, I went into general practice in 1963, and I was a clinical assistant, and we didn't have a receptionist or anything. I just sat there and said, next patient, please. And the patient came in and possibly had the doctor I was working with, had some notes, possibly didn't. But what a lot of the people came to see me for were purple hearts. And they wanted to repeat prescriptions for purple hearts. I had no idea what purple hearts were, but I soon found out. Hundreds, it seemed hundreds of the practice, mostly women in the high rise blocks, were on purple hearts. And who knows what purple hearts are? Were? Sebastian? No. Jane? No?
Yeah,
Oh.
I know of them. Yeah, they were yeah, a lot of people I know used to buy them, you
Yeah.
know, from dealers. I
Yeah.
didn't
Well,
actually.
I'll tell you what they were.
Yeah.
They were a mixture of an amphetamine and a barbiturate.
Okay.
Okay? They were a mixture of an amphetamine and a barbiturate, and they were sort of mauve shaped, and they were called purple hearts. And they were very well, they were very well received. They were uppers and downers all in one pill. And this is the 1960s, and when I went to the practice, I see all these people coming for a pre-prescription of purple hearts, because there was a lot of young people in tower blocks and misery and anxiety, the pain of living, and da-di-da-di, and it must have worked. So what happened then was that the pharmacies that stocked purple hearts were beginning to be raided by the people who wanted recreational drugs. So then we moved into the area of recreational drugs. So Purple Hearts eventually were banned. So at that point, and this is 1963, 64, 64, we've got a bit of a gap in the market, haven't we? For something that soothes away the pain of living. So one day, I was doing the practice, and the drug companies never used to make an appointment. They used to burst in front of the patients, come in and tell them, wonderful thing. So this bloke rushed in. He said, "Ah, I've got this wonderful news. I've got this wonder drug. Absolutely wonderful." He said, "Absolutely. It's great. It's got no side effects. It's absolutely, it was to wonder, to soothe away all the pains of living, free of side effects or any problems with long-term use." So this is Librium. Chlordiazepoxide, epoxide. You've all heard of Librium. That was the first specific anxiolytic. So people started to get Librium. Soon after that, probably, and that was the only specific anxiolytic. There was anxiolytic effects from the antipsychotics. And the other thing that people came for repeat prescriptions for, and the doctor had just left a pile of prescriptions out under a piece of elastic to be picked up, was Nembutal. The ones who went on Purple Hearts were on Nembutal. I mean, this is what it was like then, I tell you. So after a year or two, there was another breakthrough with Valium. Now here we come, the big player, Valium. That's the first of the benzodiazepines. And if you look, if you actually read through these notes, you'll see that the benzodiazepines affect GABA, which is arousal. So these drugs affect and alter the interaction of all the neurotransmitters that are going on in our head. So then we got Valium. So then, and this is me as a GP, quite a I think reasonable GP, but there you go. That's perhaps a bit of a question. The thing was that we had people had Valium, diazepam, 5 milligrams 3 times a day, repeat prescription, repeat prescription, repeat prescription. Now we can do that, Patricia, with that face, but then it was not like that at all. These were new drugs. These were new drugs. They've been put on the market because they're effective, but we haven't got the long-term effects of having them. So that's what happens with absolutely every drug that comes onto the market. So we then had the different generations of benzodiazepines. We had the changing of barbiturates for nighttime sleeping to Mogadon, which is one of the benzodiazepines. But the thing about hypnotics, which was for the whole of the last century, was barbiturates, things to make you sleep. But the thing about hypnotics, the what's the name of them? God, it's gone out of my head. The hypnotics, Nembutal, barbiturates, for God's sake, the barbiturates, which of course are now are classified things. The thing about barbiturates, and as someone now well into her 80s, I know that if you're taking a pill when you go to bed and you wake up, you don't know whether you've taken it. Okay, and this is what happened. And this is what happened because the therapeutic range, the effective to the toxic, was such a small range. What we call the therapeutic range was so small that they were dangerous if you took another one. So they were, but they were also the favored thing for committing suicide. And there isn't anything as effective as barbiturates that you could get and finish things off with. So this is the last century was developing new things, interacting with things, assessing them, and We've got the antidepressants. Now, the antidepressants were from about the 1950s, and their first ones were called the tricyclics because they had a three. It is their chemical configuration, and they were well tested, and on the whole, they were well used, and for depression. There were also other ones that you had to be quite careful with, which were called monoamine oxidase inhibitors. So monoamine to do with food. So that was one where you had to tell people not to eat broad beans. No broad beans for you. And I can't remember what else, but there were several other things. So, and they took longer to act. So it was the tricyclic antidepressants were tried and tested and are still used today, such as imipramine, triptazole, and they have been found to be useful to be given for pain syndromes. So quite often they're given for pain control. So when we get to the 1980s, and we've got the development of the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the happy pills, Prozac. So, what's happened to Prozac? What's happened to Prozac? It's been overused. We've discovered this is wrong, that's wrong. And it's used with much more circumspection now than it was. We've got the newer generations of antipsychotics, which have moved on from haloperidol to quetiapine, and each new generation has some improvements that have got rid of this, but they also still have drawbacks. So that's looking at anxiolytics, hypnotics. We've got hypnotics. We've been using. We had chloral hydrate and formaldehyde, but then we got the, and then we had Mogadon, and more recently, when I say recent, I'm saying probably thinking of 15 years, which is not really recent. We got what they were called the Z drugs. Has anybody had any association with anything beginning with Z being prescribed? Zopiclone is the most common one. No. The Z, called the Z drugs. Well, it was a paper on the Z drugs and the fact that they weren't the answer to insomnia that made me do that research on AT and insomnia. It was a paper that came up in the BMJ about the fact that the Z drugs, as they call them, were not as effective as they thought they were, and behavioral practices should be used. So that's why I started and did that. Which I think you've seen, haven't you? AT for insomnia cohort prospective study. Yeah. So moving on. So antidepressants. The antidepressants we've got now are a refinement on Prozac, like fluoxetine is one that is an anxiolytic and an antidepressant, which is very useful. Got anti-Parkinson drugs. What else have we got? We've got mood stabilizers, which are important for the bipolar conditions. They were introduced in 19. Oh no, not that one. No. Mood stabilizers, lithium, and carbamazepine. Now, these are drugs which stabilize the seesawing of the manic mania depression. But they're quite dangerous. And lithium is lessens the severity and frequency of manic attacks. It also stabilizes mood between major attacks. So a useful concept if it works, a useful thing to have the mood stabilize, but at a cost. The majority of patients experience at least one side effect, the most common of which are gastrointestinal. Lithium is a very interesting element, closely related to sodium and potassium, and therefore widely distributed as salts in nature, in plants and animals. It's involved in modifying endocrine and enzyme function. So you can imagine where it gets to. I mean, it's part of a whole thing of metabolism. The lithium is. And carbamazepine is related to things. So I think we're all rather tired and we've got to the end. So I'm going to, the anticonvulsants, I'll just read this out, a diverse group of chemicals which control fits. The mechanism of the anticonvulsant actions, that is, preventing the spread of excitation in the brain, are not all known, but include stabilizing neuronal excitability, affecting the permeability of the cell membrane, and altering neurotransmitter levels. Now, I think we've had something. You won't really be having many people coming with epilepsy, but you may well. And I've had at least two who have had their lives have been a major thing to do with epilepsy, and I took them both on. And in actual fact, they do. It depends. It depends where they are with their condition. One of the people who came to me was because her epilepsy was unpredictable. I think I've said this before. She was so anxious she didn't know whether she was going to have one, and so we dealt with the anxiety with the autogenic training, and it worked very well. And the other person, I can't remember why she was there, but it was not. It was it was to do with living with the fact that you've got epilepsy. And my friend, who you know, Jane Carr, his little granddaughter has developed epilepsy, and the effect on the family is enormous. And the thought about this child having this for the rest of her lives through school, through this, through what she can do and what she can't do, and the effect on the fear of the anxiety. I mean, I think parents have lost peace of mind going to school. I mean, there are things that are ramifications of these conditions that go through and may well come to you as the grandparent or the parent of someone because they've lost their peace of mind. They've lost. So that these things infiltrate right through. And I think I'm going to wind up now by reading out this, which I think is brilliant, by Aldous Huxley. Okay, about medication and drugs. Because what we know now is that people going to raves and having uppers and downers and sideways and inside out ones, and this is happening. So we do seek some psychotropic action from somewhere, don't we? I mean, alcohol, for God's sake. I mean, why do we have that? That has a psychotropic effect. I haven't even mentioned that. So here's an end thought. Okay. If we could sniff or swallow something that would, for 5 or 6 hours each day, abolish our solitude as individuals, atone us with our fellows in a glowing exaltation of affection, and make life in all its aspects seem not only worth living, but divinely beautiful and significant. And if this heavenly, world-transfiguring drug were of such a kind that we could wake up next morning with a clear head and an undamaged constitution, then it seems to me all our problems would be solved and the earth would become a paradise. That's Aldous Huxley, of course, who did a lot of experimentation with psychedelic drugs, but I think that's absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to say
Yes.
amen to that. Does anybody want
Yes.
to sort of say anything about or have any thoughts about this has been going on?
I'd like to ask if there are certain drugs that may be prescribed to a person that could trigger mental health problems or to exacerbate them.
Sorry, Patricia, prescribe what? Sugar?
If someone was prescribed drugs, like say any drugs that either that you've mentioned today or that can they affect men? Are there some drugs that could exacerbate a problem with mental health or trigger mental health in someone? Can it do damage to the brain is what I'm asking.
You mean the drugs that you're, why are you prescribing these drugs? What conditions are you thinking of that someone's prescribed something for?
Pain management, for instance.
Sorry?
Pain management.
Oh, pain. Oh, yeah. Well, of course, opiates. I haven't put
Yes.
opiates.
Oh,
Opiates down here. I mean, opiates are the drug par excellence that has an effect. And on the whole, they have a wonderful effect on the mind. And if they didn't have the problems that they have, they might come into that nice end thought because I can remember when I had when I've had one of my ghastly operations, having some morphine and feeling great.
Well, I ask because I had a very bad experience earlier this year in hospital with, and I didn't know what it was I was being given because I was pretty ill. I was pretty out of it. And some of the things that you mentioned, I was hallucinating, I was delusional, I was a danger to myself. In fact, I needed stitches in my head because I thought I had to escape and I crashed into a wall, things like that. I mean, it was pretty
So you, sorry,
scary.
Patricia, you had a drug prescribed for
Yeah, but
some.
they overdosed me. I didn't know
Sorry?
what was happening, and they just kept
But
giving me.
why were you
It
prescribed the
is
drug? Hey.
post-surgery.
That sounds well.
Post-surgery, wasn't
Right,
it?
this was before the surgery.
All right, before the surgery.
Yeah, and after the surgery. Yeah, but I had a lot before because
So
I.
you're treated with analgesia of one sort or another, which is a medicine to relieve pain. And it had a profound effect on you.
Yes,
And
I
you don't know what
actually,
it was. Did you not find out what it was?
it was tramadol. I
Oh,
found out,
tramadol. I've
but
heard so many.
they were
Yeah.
giving it to me through,
A
my arm,
driver, a driver. Yeah.
and also by a tablet. And I was so out of it, I didn't know what was going on.
I've heard of people going bonkers on tramadol.
And I
It's a
did. I
really,
thought.
really dangerous drug.
Yeah, I damn injured myself, and I didn't. I thought the people who said they were doctors, I was telling them they weren't doctors. I thought another one was poisoning me. I mean, it was horrible. And I just wonder, it was when I was thinking about some of the other things, and I was thinking that's what I experienced. That's what I experienced. You know that, and I, well, I've got a scar up here still. I had to have stitches in my head, and goodness knows what else. So,
That's an
I just.
awful experience because at that point, Patricia, you were given a drug which for relief of your symptoms, you had no idea it was having an effect on your mind, and so you presumably with your mental functioning disorganized by this drug, you weren't able to express fully that you thought the drug was doing this, that, or the other.
I didn't know what was going
No,
on.
you didn't know what was going on. Yeah.
But I
It was
just
awful.
it's kind of sort of I don't know, just hearing some things today, and I just wondered, could I have done other damage to my brain? Because I've had two brain scans since then as well, but yeah.
But that had done permanent damage, you mean? Could I couldn't answer that.
Well,
One
I'm
hope, one
sorry. I
hopes
mean,
not.
I'm taking it
So.
too far. It was just a
But I
question.
mean, your personal experience of having something, a medication that was given for your pain relief or whatever, having a psychotropic effect, and that's what I say about it wasn't given because you had any mental symptoms or psychological psychiatric symptoms, given because you were in pain. But that, I mean, that's why treating people, you never know what response they're going to have. You don't know response. You don't know what response someone, if you give them an aspirin, is going to have. You know, you can have catastrophic bleeding and die. I mean, you just do not. But the prescribing of psychotropic drugs, and I would say tramadil is on the hinterland between analgesia and psychotropic medicine, because it has some awful effects. It's such a strain medication. So I just think that you demonstrate how different people respond to medicines that have a psychotropic action.
Yeah. I mean,
And we might hopefully presume that one or two doses and having that effect is a kind of one-off transient episode rather than actually doing damage to a brain, one would hope.
I suppose why I'm asking, what worries me was, because I wasn't operated on, I was in a hospital bed for 4 days before they operated on me. And I was just, people just kept coming and slamming a new thing in my arm and stuff, you know. So I honestly feel I was overdosed with it.
Well, it sounds like it. Mm-hmm. So that's poor care. But tramadil is a dangerous drug, irrespective of pain or suffering. I'm not that I prescribe now, but I wouldn't prescribe that for anybody, nor would I take it. But it is used, and then we've got the opiates. I haven't touched on the opiates here. You know, we hear about the synthetic opiate, fentanyl, and the fentanyl canisters everywhere. And so I think, actually, one way or another, that psychotropic effect or the effect on the brain are always going to be around, because one way or another, we seek them either legitimately for symptoms and for pain control, or we seek them
recreational.
Recreation. Mm. And I think that'll always be with us one way or another. Mm. We've got another one coming up now, which is vaping. Okay, so nicotinamide is safe, ha ha ha. It isn't, and so on and so forth. So everything that's put out, this is great, this is safe. Librium, Valium, this, that, and the other. Another drug which is not psychotropic drug, but in actual fact, one way or another, is steroids. Now steroids are used for certain inflammatory conditions. When I can remember, it was probably about 1965 or 66, they came out as being used topically for the first time. And it was a miracle having a topical steroid for eczema. I mean, the eczemas were dreadful. And that was a miracle. So it was prescribed miraculously. And then they discovered that if you used it too much, there were side effects, and you must never use it on your face. And then the stronger serum. So it's not use of a new substance. It's overuse leading to abuse. And that is, you know, with time. But actually, in support of psychotropic drugs, there are a lot of people who wouldn't be able to function. There have been a lot of people who've been prescribed inappropriately, but there are a lot of people who wouldn't be able to function without them. So it's a balance. It's good prescribing. It's looking at the features of the illness. It might not be just that. You're not treating schizophrenia. You're treating someone who is depressed, insomnia, anxious, and so on. So you want to get the best fit, but always you have the individual response. Always you have the individual response. So, shall we leave it at that? Anybody
Yes,
want to say anything else?
thank you.
Donna, have you got anything to say? I think we
No, I must move on, and Anne,
right.
thank you very much indeed. That's been very insightful, and I think, of course, we must remind ourselves that we don't have to do any of this. The likeliest thing that we are going to observe in our clients is that it's quite clear they don't need these drugs anymore. That's the most likely.
Well, yes and no.
Yes
I
and
think
no. Yes.
we should not be saying we're going to get you off the drugs, not ever. But
I'm not
actually,
saying that, of course. I am
no,
saying that
no.
when we're working with clients, we would
We're
never
working
meddle
with
with them
clients,
anyway.
absolutely. But all of this information is on the internet for you just to look into. And the more you look into things, the more you'll understand, and make your own practice just out of interest. And so on, and supporting your client, because I mean, someone perhaps like Patricia, who's had a really bad experience, and finding out and discussing that as a aside to what's happened and so that, a sort of support worker, but an informed support worker.
Worker, yeah.
And the more you're informed, the more you'll be able to understand and empathize and help. So lovely. Okay, well, I think that's my lot for today.
Thank you so much.
I think I see you tomorrow. Is
Yes.
that, yeah, and with Stephen.
With Stephen. Yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Anne.
Thank
So,
you.
yeah.
Thank you.